All who are able are invited to stand for the reading of the gospel lesson, the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to St. Luke. Now, all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him, and the Pharisees and scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." And so he told them this parable. Then Jesus said, "There was a young man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' And so he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had, and he traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered his property in dissolute living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. Now he would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off, and he went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion, and ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, put it on him, put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it. Let's eat, celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants, and he asked, 'What's going on?' And he replied, 'Your brother has come. And your father's killed the fatted calf because he's gotten him back safe and sound.' Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, 'Listen, all these years I've been working like a slave for you, and I never disobeyed your command, and yet you have never given me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found.' The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. The gospel of the Lord." You may be seated. Romantic comedies. You know what I'm talking about, right? They're making a comeback, it seems. Generally, the gist of it is a man and a woman meet. Well, at least in the Hollywood version, it's typically a man and a woman. And they don't really like each other right away. She's a buttoned-up professional, and he's a careless slob. And they eventually wind up parting ways, usually because of some argument, like his failure to take life seriously, and because she's way up too tight, uptight, something like that. Now, it's clear to everybody that they like each other, that at their core, they were made for each other. And even though everybody else on the planet can see the attraction, they just do not get it. And then something happens while they're apart, One of them experiences some kind of epiphany, right? We are so meant to be together. How did I not see this? So this epiphany, which is shared with a sort of witty, quirky best friend, who gives a knowing look as if to say, are you really now just realizing this? Right? Everybody else, even that emotional vampire down in accounting who wears brown suits and white socks, knows that you're perfect for each other. Now, unfortunately, the love interest who hasn't yet seen the light gives up on the whole pointless pursuit, quits her job, goes to find the meaning of life at the exciting advertising job in New York, which has been waiting for her all this time. Now, the one who's just figured out the meaning of love and life finally works up the courage, and he goes to see her at her apartment, which is now empty, and he makes a grand gesture by dropping everything to chase her to the airport. Oh, he gets in a cab driven by a suitably sarcastic, typically it's somebody who's not from this country. And he goes to find her in the airport before she leaves on the big jet plane from LA to the Big Apple. Now, there are variations like if he's given up on love and is going to Algeria to join the French Foreign Legion, right? Then she'll follow on the back of a cranky camel, led, of course, by a suitably sarcastic camel driver. Now, just as the chase looks like it's going to be futile, she walks out of the restroom at LAX when her flight starts to board, and she trips over a mislaid suitcase and falls right into his arms, which are filled with an airport hot dog and a beer in a huge plastic cup that he spills all over both of them. Fed up with life, she starts to complain that he should watch where he's going as he tries to pull a stray French fry from her hair. Now, this star-crossed couple finally recognize each other, and she vaguely realizes what's happening but resists by saying that she just can't do this anymore and that she needs to be true to herself and quit chasing rainbows. All right, so I've told you all of that to ask you this. What happens next? What happens? He grabs her by the face, ketchup smeared all over his hands, and he looks longingly into her questioning eyes, and he kisses her, right? He gives her a kiss. I mean, we know, don't we? We know what's supposed to happen. We've seen this movie or some variation, complete with stock characters and comic subplots, literally hundreds of times. We know what's going to happen in the end. Our only real suspense is how they're going to overcome the obstacles that seem to keep them perpetually apart. Romantic comedies employ a series of tropes, which is to say, sort of common literary devices, in the service of plots that are so well-worn, we know almost immediately what kind of story we're seeing and how it will inevitably end, right? But romantic comedies aren't the only storylines that we recognize, are they? Westerns with the good guys and the bad guys, action-adventure movies with bare-chested heroes and who escape fireballs, slash advancing hordes, slash enemy spies, slash alien invaders slash cunning mob boss, just in the nick of time. Sports movies where the beleaguered and overmatched underdog finally finds the strength and the motivation to defeat the odds and superior opponent. Well, we know. We've seen them all in some variation so many times, we just know. But recognizable plot lines aren't unique only to our culture. I mean, other cultures throughout history have had their own recognizable plot lines, complete with their own stock characters. In the ancient Near East, for instance, there was a common morality tale that parents told their children. Instead of beginning with once upon a time or a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, This popular ancient Near Eastern story began, there was a man who had two sons. Not unlike the way that generations have used fairy tales and Aesop's fables to teach children right from wrong. This story of the man with two sons was a popular fable meant to teach children the virtue of responsibility. And if you're going to show kids how to be good grown-ups, you can see how this story's supposed to go. There once was a man who had two sons. The younger son was brash, unpredictable, while the older son was measured, reliable. The younger son asked for his inheritance, which he wound up squandering on fast cars, good liquor, and women. Now, the older son, he did everything right. Stayed home, took care of the family business, always remembered to put clean litter in the cat box. When the younger son returned home, hat in hand, dad would sit him down and give him a good lecture about how upstanding young men put their families first, spend their money wisely, learn how to wear ties and aftershave, right? Now, at this point, the father would call in the older brother to drive the point home. Well, look at Kevin here. He's done everything he's supposed to do. Showed up to work on time every day, did his homework before watching PBS. Now he's headed to accounting school, from which he'll graduate, get married, have brilliant children, oversee the tending of an amazingly green lawn, and eventually drive a Buick. Why can't you be more like Kevin? And just to make sure you've learned your lesson, you're going to have to sleep on the couch in the family room, hand over your iPad, and wash your brother's athletic socks as a condition of returning home. Now that's how the story is supposed to go. The moral of this story, children, is eat your vegetables, wash behind your ears, and obey your parents. In short, like Kevin. Now that's a perfectly good story, isn't it? I mean, you can raise fine children on stories like that. Lord knows generations of parents have tried. So when Jesus breaks into story in our text for this morning by saying there was a man who had two sons, everybody in the audience turns around and sort of nods to each other. They know what's coming. They looked with approval, tapping their children on the shoulders as if to say, listen up, kiddies. You really need to pay attention to this one. But then Jesus goes and he screws the whole story up. I mean, everything's going great, just the way the script goes, until we get to that part about the father running out to meet the younger son and not giving him a good, stern talking to, the one that everybody knows he deserves. Instead, he says, welcome home, and he's going to throw him a party. Now, how are you going to raise responsible adults telling a story like that? I mean, generally speaking, there are a couple of popular ways of preaching this parable. I've preached it a few ways myself. I've focused on the expansive love shown to the younger son, demonstrating that none of us are so far gone that God can't find us as we walk back toward home. The grace of a parent toward a wayward child who's come back. That's good, right? I mean, I've also preached this from the perspective of the older brother and how we good Christian folks probably ought to identify first with Kevin, who's shown up for work 3 minutes early for the past 25 years, and how easy it is for us to look down our noses at the wild son. But you preach and you say, but you know, the older brother needs to get over himself. That's us. I mean, both cases kind of contradict the moral lesson that was intended in telling this story. In its original form, glorifying the first son would have been seen as scandalous to the crowd, as this was meant to convey to those prone to reckless living that, you know, slow and steady wins the race. While the younger son ends up eating frozen pot pies and sucking down Sunny D, while his older brother smugly gets to drive dad's Lexus. So, if we wanted, we could still salvage this as a kind of a morality tale about a son who comes to his senses, returns home, suitably chastened, ready after all of his youthful shenanigans to take on the job of acting like a grown-up. Now, in this version, it's a story of repentance. Teaches kids about the dangerous world out there, and if you mess up, you got to learn how to say you're sorry. Or failing that, this could be a morality tale about how it doesn't pay to be bitter and a bitter and spiteful weenie, right? The older son, on this telling of the story, needs to get over his feelings of resentment, learn to forgive his brother. That's also something that we want to teach our kids. And these takes are also fine. I mean, I've preached them. Unfortunately, though, both the repentant younger brother and the sullen older brother have as their focus the wrong character. Or if not the wrong characters, then at least the less interesting characters. Because I think the father is actually the key to this story, at least the way that Jesus tells it. See, because in Jesus' hands, the story of the prodigal son ceases to be a morality tale at all. If the original purpose of this common story was to reinforce the benefits of being dependable, which is to say, of being like Kevin, well, then Jesus just ruins it. In fact, Jesus takes a story about good parenting and turns it into a late-night infomercial on how to make sure your children learn to avoid responsibility and turn out like Charlie Sheen. I mean, if this is supposed to be a kind of Jesus-y version of Aesop's fable, well, then ask yourself this. After the way the father treats the two sons, how is he ever going to get another honest day's work out of either one of them? You see what I mean? The real kicker in this story, though, is that the father loves both of his sons, even though it's hard as onlookers to understand why. To the younger son, he gives a ring and a party, and to the older son, he gives everything else he owns. Son, you're always with me. All that I have is yours. Now, what kind of a God gives a pass to both the self-absorbed party animal and the self-satisfied weenie? I mean, to do that, it just encourages bad behavior all the way around. I mean, it's lousy parenting is what it is. But think about this with me for a minute. What if the point of Jesus' reworking of this time-honored story isn't about tweaking it for the purposes of giving it a new moral? What if Jesus uses this story not to shame kids into picking up their dirty underwear and setting the dinner table? What if Jesus if what he's up to is simply trying to answer this question? What kind of a God could love a jerk like me? What would a God who could love everybody look like? And by everybody, I mean everybody. And that's not an easy question to answer because most of us have fairly definite ideas about who's actually worthy of God's love and who's not even worthy of aspiring to it. But apparently God's not nearly as picky as we are. I mean, just look at the plot. This parable is a story about bad parenting, about a father who's willing to give everything away, even to kids who've proven they don't deserve it. It's a story about the love of a parent who persists in pursuing us, even though we continue to run away from home or continue to turn our faces away from the music, even after we've been ceaselessly invited into the party. It's a story about lousy parenting. I mean, just think what would happen if we started following this example and just loving everybody, even though they don't deserve it. Right? How's that going to work? Try to get that through the Supreme Court right now. We need to think carefully about what Jesus is selling us here. Since we're the children of this parent who stands looking out the window, waiting for us to come home, waiting for us to come inside, then we need, I think, to ask ourselves, if that's our parent, then who are we looking for? Who is it that we're standing at the window waiting to come home? Because here's the thing, there's not a lot of people who are trying to find their way back home. But they're scared, in many cases, scared that we who've been here so long, we who've faithfully tended the fields for all these years, they're scared that maybe some of them, we don't want them here. They want to know that they're just as welcome in this home as we are. And if we're ever going to be like the parent who waits for us, our job isn't deciding who should be on the guest list. Our job is popping champagne corks when another one comes down the road toward home. And even more than that, we've got to figure out how to stop looking out the window waiting for them to find their way home. And instead, we need to go out into the street and find them while they're still a long way off. And we need to run to them and offer an embrace before they ever promise to get their acts together and start being responsible like us. Because we're all looking for home, aren't we? I mean, that's a well-worn plot. But maybe the point of this story is that even after all the ways we've tried to run from it, with a parent standing, nose pressed against the glass, maybe home is looking for us. Amen.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church podcast. If you liked what you heard, please rate the podcast on iTunes, retweet the link, or just tell your friends. Godspeed until next time on the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church podcast.